This is a recording from the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at civilpodcast.com, your source for on-demand radio shows, lectures, and more, updated daily at civilpodcast.com. What are the true costs of buying food from around the globe? How much food can we grow close to home? Is it enough to support us? And can we afford it? Those are some of the questions explored during a University of Virginia course this past year. Healthy Communities, Healthy Food Systems, Global Local Connections is the third installment of the class, which is co-taught by Timothy Beatley and Tanya Denkla-Cobb. On April 23, 2008, the class delivered its findings, which are now brought to you by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. This two-hour recording is introduced by Tim Beatley.
I want to welcome everybody today. My name is Tim Beatley. I teach in the Department of Urban and Environmental Planning in the School of Architecture at UVA. And Tanya, along with Tanya Denkla-Cobb, who's we've been co-instructing this community food systems class for the third time now. This is the third iteration of this course. And maybe to start, just a tad bit of history about this. It's we teach in an urban planning program, urban planning department, and food and community food systems is a relatively recent addition to the curricula of planning programs around the country. We'd like to think we're not exactly the first program to do this, but we're one of the first. So increasingly, we see food, thinking about food, how it's produced and where it's produced and how sustainably it's produced, as being important elements in any community planning process. That food production we increasingly see as a kind of important infrastructure, if you will. And so this class kind of reflects that we think important trend. So this is the third time, and this year the focus is a little bit different. You might be taken aback by this word glocal. It's a word that we've been frequently using in the planning program, right? We had a glocal Thanksgiving actually this past fall, and so the focus this year, Charlottesville glocal food system. In past classes, the students have done a marvelous job, sort of understanding where food in the region is being produced, what sort of interesting food stories are here, what kind of policy responses, policy things, and planning things we ought to be doing to help encourage local food. And you'll see from the presentations we're continuing in that vein, but the glocal emphasis is a little bit different. And by glocal we mean we are connected to the global environment. We know that we want to support local food and local producers and connect local producers and local consumers, but we also recognize that we probably can't completely disconnect from the global environment or the global economy, and probably we don't want to. We care about other countries and we care about other cultures, and we want to influence what happens around the world. So this class is a combination of the global, and this will become clearer, hopefully, as you hear the presentations, but connecting the global and the local. So I think I'm going to stop, turn it over to Tanya to offer her welcome as well.
Thanks, and as Tim said, my name is Tanya Denkla-Cobb. I'm at the Institute for Environmental Negotiation, which is part of the Department of Urban and Environmental Planning. And let me just say a little bit more about this is that this course this year has been sponsored by the UVA Center for Global Health. And so one of the things you won't see today, but we were very interested in that the students did, in addition to this project, they also did case studies on food projects in other nations. And those food projects had to be connected somehow to community health. And so one of the keys to this class this year was trying to draw the connection between food and community health and sustainability, you could say, or the new word that's being used a lot is resilience. The community resilience is often connected to its health, the health of its citizens, which is connected to their food system. So we looked at nations around the world, and then all of the students were asked to choose a project here in our community and to start trying to make these connections between how, where are the sources of the inputs into these different parts of our food system, how much of our food system is locally based, and how much can we even find out? Do we even know? How far can we push it? How far can we push our knowledge about where our food is coming from? And you'll see some of the answers, that there are some walls, and that we can't always know where our food is coming from. And so what we hope this will do is raise some questions for you all in terms of where is it that we want our food system to be, and how can we as a community begin to improve and enhance our local food system. And if we want to be connecting with the global aspect of the food system, what can we do to improve that? So these are the kinds of questions we hope the student projects will raise. We know they will raise these questions. And what I'm going to do is to ask you all to hold your questions until we get through all the presentations. Everybody has this program guide, we hope, and we're going to try to go in order. So there's 9 presentations that will take us a little less than an hour. And then we'll have a good hour, or as long as you want to hang out, for questions and discussion. The first students up are Nick Feit and Nicolette Lung doing Wild Oats Farm.
All right. Hello, everyone. I'm sure you're all glad this is not the Board of Architectural Review's meeting on the intrinsic value of exterior siding. So without further ado, I'm going to get into our presentation. My partner, who's sitting down in front, Nicolette, and she's enjoying a coconut macaroon, and you should also, we traveled to Scottsville to Wild Oats Farm, which is owned by Susan Swales. She also operates it and does all the work, all the watering, all the caretaking, very involved with everything. And it's approximately 28 miles from Charlottesville, or where we started clocking on my car's odometer. And this is a picture of her barn. I don't know if there's any way to shut the lights up here. Nicolette, can you get the switches over there? So we started our project with a few basic goals. Like Tim was saying, we don't know where our food comes from, but there's also this idea that maybe food is produced locally, but where do the inputs come from? Are they local inputs, or are they more global inputs? So we wanted to look at someone who's producing food locally, but where were the inputs coming from? So we tried to look at both where the outputs were going, where were her markets for her meat, but also where were the things coming from, both the animals, the feed, the fencing, whatever we could do feasibly, what could we find out about those products? We also wanted to know, is there some kind of law or processing policies that affect, how local farmers act and what they can do kind of on a local level as far as direct marketing and things like that? Just looking more at kind of the healthiness of the farm's operation in general. And who is really benefiting from this kind of conservation, local, direct operation in terms of, both socially, environmentally, and economically? And the picture you're seeing here, this is her Pyrenees Marannus, and this dog is one of her most important inputs, as she's told us. This is for keeping kind of the sheep where they need to be, but also kind of keeping animals that don't need to be there, like coyotes and hawks, away from young produce and or young livestock like that. The dog is quite large, and I couldn't actually get a picture of any of the sheep or goats without the dog kind of coming between me and the sheep. So imagine a personal bodyguard. So our methods primarily were on-site interviews, both with Susan at her farm, and her main supplier of agricultural inputs. So there's a Augusta Farm Co-op is a locally run farm supply store, which is just up the road, and we stopped there, and they had lots of information about where Susan gets a lot of her products from fencing to grain to fence posts, animal medicine, things like that. So we made two visits to both them, and we sat down and talked with them. That's where most of our information came from. So one of the key findings, and this is in her barn, we found some eggs. One of the key things that we kind of unearthed was this non-cash economy which exists in rural areas and between farmers. As Susan said, farmers are very land-rich, capital-rich, and cash-poor. So there's a lot of trading that goes on. For example, some of the herds that she has, she's traded maybe a certain amount of cattle for a sheep ram, and she's used that ram to kind of build up both her sheep herd, but also kind of improve the overall quality of the animals that she has there. So there's this bargaining that takes place outside of the economy, which is both maybe for it's better economically for the farmers, but also maybe for necessities reasons. Somebody might have something you need, and you have something they need, and you know there's no need really to put a price on it as far as cash goes. But the other key finding we have two maps. This map shows where her kind of major inputs come from. So we have a map of Virginia here. I'm going to attempt to use this laser and not hurt anybody. So down here this is a picture of one of the goats. She got her goats from Chesterfield, Virginia, so south side of Richmond. Her sheep, which aren't on here, some of them came from Suffolk, which is down here. The fence posts for her forest feedlot for her hogs came from a local sawmill outside of Richmond. The picture of Augusta Co-op is right here. Some of her inputs came from as far away as Mexico. I think some of the fencing did. Her water trough came from Illinois and Iowa, was another input, another kind of fencing that she used. So you can see here, there are certain inputs which are much closer than others. As far as the animals, probably for, you know, just economic reasons, it's easier to get animals that are closer. Transport costs are more. But then there are other things that come from much further away. And so we can think, you know, to what degree is our food actually local? Like, you know, maybe a first degree, second degree, third degree kind of input. So these are her markets. And you can see, like, her markets are a much closer geographic area than that of where her inputs came from. So there are three farmers markets which Susan routinely goes to during the summer, Charlottesville, Fluvanna, and Scottsville. But she also takes some animals to livestock markets in Madison County and Harrisonburg. So those are a little bit further, and you can see the nicely grilled piece of meat represents those livestock markets. Yummy. Okay, so some of the challenges that we just saw for Susan in general, as far as kind of staying local and doing what she does, the availability of labor has been a real challenge for her. Even though Susan pays very competitive wage, she's had, she estimates close to 20 different laborers come just because the degree of the challenge of the physicalness, or the physicality of agricultural work has just made it hard for her to find people to keep coming back and keep returning to the job. Oil prices, you all can relate to that today. Oil hit an all-time high. If you didn't know that yet, I apologize for telling you that bad news. But everything from transporting her animals to market to the plastic that she processes her meat in to be sold, all those things. Energy, oil is involved with all that, so all those prices have gone up, and there's a limit to how much people can absorb those costs without having to say, you know, I can't do this anymore, I just don't have the money. Customer education. A lot of people don't know that Susan is a conservationist. She has all of the area on her property, which is around waterways, has been set aside in conservation easement. Her animals are grass-fed or grass-finished, and so there's real health benefits from grass-fed beef over what you would find in the store as far as corn-fed beef. And some customers don't necessarily know that, and maybe if they did know that, you know, there'd be more of an appeal for her product. Weather is a huge challenge for her. The size of the herds that she has directly depends on how much rain she gets, and because that depends, that dictates how much grass is available and how many animals she can keep. And those are things you can't predict. Market seasonality is another problem that Susan faces. Some people don't realize that beef cattle live year-round, while vegetables that are grown and taken to a farmer's market only exist in the warmer months. And so some people stop coming to get their food, even though, you know, she's still there, still has meat for sale. Wrong item. So we came up with a few ideas that maybe, you know, could help her and help all of us in the long run. This whole process is about kind of discovering opportunities between us. One is to try to find ways that agricultural policies can be changed to help local farmers and smaller farmers so that we can get food on a more local basis. Maybe, you know, allowing processing to happen at smaller scales or things like that. Food education, so there's a guide that tells you all about where the local food sources are around here, but maybe, you know, something that shows just the basic benefits from local food. Maybe there are health benefits to it, maybe there are environmental benefits that are not, you know, aware of widely in the community. And then maybe some way for her to find, you know, there are people who want to work jobs, there are jobs. Is there some way that we can match those two better so that she has a more reliable, stable system of labor for her farm? And with that, I guess I'll turn it over to Jenny with the next presentation.
Okay, hello, I'm Jenny Jackson, and along with Elaine Quick, who's in the back, we did a local materials analysis of Roundabout Farm. And Roundabout is a small family-run farm in Keswick, Virginia, run by Rob and Megan Weary. Many of you will recognize them as a city market regular and a growing CSA in their second year, with shares still available. They operate on 76 acres with 10 acres in cultivation this year. And they pride themselves on using sustainable and environmentally friendly practices. And their goal, they're committed to providing their community with healthy food from healthy land. And we found this to be just quite an inspirational operation that they're doing, and really enjoyed getting to learn more about their process, and hope you will as well. Okay, our goal for the analysis was to trace the original inputs into the soil and what channels they went through to arrive at the farm. And these are just some photos taken from the farm. Okay, our methodology specifically, we were looking at inputs that go directly into the soil from the last year of farm production. Seeds, fertilizer, compost, and pest control products. And these are some more pictures from the farm. Now, they did use in the last year over 260 different kinds of seeds. So to deal with that, we looked at each company that they got seeds from and just selected a sampling from each company to limit it. We got a wide variety, but did not look at all 260 types of seeds. Okay, so this is our key findings. As you can see on the map, the green is Roundabout Farm. And again, this is just a sampling, but as you can see, coming from all over the world, the blue represents initial direct inputs to Roundabout Farm, and the orange represents inputs that go to those suppliers, so two tiers away. And the closest input we traced was horse manure from 1 mile away. At Belcourt Farm, and the furthest input was Savoy cabbage from Japan, and it went through Jordan Seed Company in Minnesota, a total of 7,030 miles. Okay, we also looked at outputs of the farm. As you can see, they are quite involved in the community, supplying their CSA, City Market, a lot of local restaurants, and other stores. Okay, and some challenges, ideas, and opportunities. Challenges, in talking with them, we found that they would really like to source things locally and look, you know, make very conscious decisions in their buying. But due to these considerations, availability, cost, reliability, and quality, often local options are not available. So they, you know, turn to the other companies and make very conscious decisions about what they purchase. Some ideas and opportunities. Again, we just found their operation to be very inspirational, and as a community, there's many opportunities to support local agriculture, support restaurants that buy local fruits and vegetables, and you know, look for it on the menu and ask for it, support the restaurants that are buying things locally. And then another idea, kind of going along with the other ideas, kind of creating just a forum to connect farms and both buyers and suppliers. So for example, if a farm had some excess vegetables some week, it could kind of be like a Craigslist for farms, you know, posting, and then restaurants could connect with it if they wanted to use that for their menu that week. And then also on the other end, connecting suppliers, kind of just a database of everything that's available in the community, so farms would know if new things came available to buy locally, and just to provide more options and information for local establishments. And with that, I'd like to thank you for your time and pass it on to Feast. All right, so we're going to switch gears a little bit now and talk about the food system from the perspective of the retailer. So myself and Fania, my partner, we looked at Feast, which is a grocer that sells both local and global artisan foods. Fania and I worked with Kate Collier, the owner of Feast, to assess both the global and local aspects of this grocer. Some of the goals of our project were to examine the local and global inputs. We looked at specifically the wine, cheese and olives, and local produce. And to do this, we analyzed the master inventory and ordering lists that Kate was nice enough to provide us with. We also created two market baskets of comparable local and global food products and to compare the food miles. And finally, we developed a best practices guide for local business owners desiring to support the local food movement. So first off, we mapped the beer and wine places of origin, and this comes from the master ordering list provided from Feast. So it's not necessarily everything that's in stock at one time, but anything that they may have ordered in the past. And as you can see, the top places of origin are France, Virginia, and Italy. And within Virginia, Albemarle County has the most beer and wines coming to Feast. Next we looked at the cheese and olives that Feast orders. Again, France, United States, and Italy came in as the top three places of origin. The little red dots represent independent cheesemakers that Feast purchases from, and the beige circles represent cheeses that come to Feast through a distributor. So we also, our second goal was to create these market baskets, and at the top right, you'll see a picture of the global market basket that we created. We selected items from 8 different categories: sparkling wine, cheese, egg or dairy, jam, meat, produce, sauce or salsa, and wine. And as you can see, the total distance was about 24,000 miles, with an average distance of 3,000 miles for each product coming to Feast. So we did the same thing for a local basket, pictured on the top. With the same, we picked products from the same categories that I listed before. This time for the local basket, the total distance traveled was 325 miles, with an average distance of 40 miles.
All right, thank you, Meg. So now that we've given you an idea of where Feast fits into the global and local food systems, we're going to take a look at the challenges facing the local food system. and you know what we can do to address these problems. A lot of the ideas that we've gotten have come from Kate, and we hope to work with her in the future to address some of these ideas. So I want to give her credit and thank her for being here again. So the main problem that we've heard from multiple sources, you know, the two farms that you've already heard from today, as well as other people we've interviewed, is one, either there is not enough product, there's not enough supply to meet the current demand. So many people want to sign up for CSAs, and so many people want to go to the farmers market, but there aren't really that many farms in Albemarle County, at least farms that are producing goods. The second main problem, which you know some could argue is even more important than the first, is that there are insufficient networks for connecting farmers or just other producers with people who want to sell their goods. So a great solution, we think, that Kate has come up with, that we you know hope to work with her again on, is to create a community food center. It could function as a distribution point and a source, a place where farmers, producers, and retailers could connect. She sees it as a publicly owned, federally inspected facility where community members and farmers alike could create value-added products. The importance of these value-added products to the local food system is huge, and it's one of the biggest discoveries that we made in doing our research. A big reason why there aren't enough people in farming, as we discussed with Kate and, you know, read about from some other sources as well, is that young people aren't interested in going into farming. The income is not consistent enough throughout the year to make it an attractive livelihood. So the creation of value-added products would address that. If farmers could create these value-added products, they would have more consistent income throughout the year, thus making it a more attractive livelihood. These products, which could be sold at grocery stores as well as in farmers markets, would reinforce and support the local economy as well. Additionally, the community food center could serve to foster the connections and networks that we've heard are lacking. In this way, it would enhance the local food system, and it could provide a space for agriculture or cooking-related programming, as well as establish a support system for new farmers and food producers. So afterwards, we hope to hear from you guys about your ideas regarding this community food center, and anyone who would be interested in speaking with us or with Kate, I think we would welcome that. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Esther Deal, and this is my project partner, Sarah Teester, and we decided to work on the Blue Moon Diner. And one of the reasons that we chose to work with the Blue Moon Diner is just because of its presence as a historic landmark and a place that just generally I feel like everyone in this room would go and enjoy the food and the atmosphere at the diner. So really what we wanted to do was assess the value of sourcing and serving local foods at the diner according to the feasibility of pricing and cost for the owners, as well as according to the opinions and food values of the customers coming to the diner.
So in doing this, we had two main project goals. We wanted to understand the impact of the food choices on the community, the patrons, the environment, and of the success of the diner. And we also wanted to understand what the personal goals of the diner owners were, as well as the patrons regarding local foods and what their views would affect how much they would want to pay or what that would affect the bottom line of the restaurant.
So how Sarah and I went about this was we first came together to decide exactly how and what we wanted to find concerning our research for the diner. So we met with the owners and operators of the diner to understand their priorities and their concerns to be able to assess their interest in sourcing local foods. We also placed a customer survey within the diner to understand the concerns and interests of the people coming to the diner, because that was also something that we felt was very important. We also interviewed Lisa Reeder to get her comments and ideas as far as being able to affordably source local foods. And we also tallied a select amount of dishes to see how many of those were being bought on during high peak times that people would be coming into the diner, and we wanted to assess where these foods were being sourced from. Finally, we want to share our findings and ideas with the diner after our project is over.
And some of those findings and challenges were that the most important thing to the diner as in regards to purchasing local food was the time and the money involved. How much time would it take to research these local food sources, and what would that cost if it is an additional cost, in fact, be to the diner, and how would they pass that along to their consumers? The second concern that was voiced to us by the owners were how could they secure year-round food at affordable prices. Of course, Virginia, it does get cold. It's not like California climate, so we don't have the year-round availability as some other places do, and that certainly affects the cost of the food. We also ran into, as investigating our project, that it's very difficult to trace the sources of food, and I think a lot of the other groups are going to be mentioning this as well. Government laws don't really work with consumers to give you the information about where your food is coming from. So a lot of times we ran into very roadblocks finding out where the food would come from, and sometimes we could only get the country of origin. We couldn't get a specific locale or a specific farm where the produce was coming from. We also, through our customer survey, we realized that there's a lot of confusion over why local foods cost more and that what actually entails local foods. And this was from our customer comment card. And this was sort of surprising to us, that there's really a lack of knowledge in the general consumers that went to the restaurant about what the local food movement was. And again, also in that comment card, we learned that customers are really concerned about price and selection and atmosphere, and that local food didn't really come up until we were specific about that particular question as being a concern in their dining experience. And the last point was something actually that was brought to our attention by Mark in our first meeting, and he was really concerned about how to create a harmonious cycle, and I think you're going to hear this in a lot of the presentations, between what farmers can produce, how much they can sell their products for, what a restaurant can buy their products for, and what a customer is willing to pay. So it's sort of a harmonious cycle that really needs to be achieved through the farmers, the producers, and the consumers.
So in actually looking at the maps of where the food is coming from the diner, you'll see that the lines only go to states, because that is as far as I got within the United States. I spoke with a man that works in the butcher at Reed's, and he only knew that the beef was coming from Pennsylvania, and he only knew that the poultry and the pork was coming from within Virginia, no specific farms. And onions are coming from Texas, cheese is coming from Wisconsin, all salads are coming from California, Northern California, Southern California, depending on the time of year. So it was just very vague descriptions of where the foods were coming from, as well as with the food coming from all around the world. Our furthest distance was food coming from Vietnam, which was really just spices, because that cannot be grown within the U.S. But again, the closest thing that was coming from outside of the U.S. was tomatoes and salads that were being grown in Mexico. So once again, it was a little bit frustrating, because we were hoping to find, to be able to talk with some of these farmers and people that were growing this food, but we could only get to the country, like Sarah mentioned before.
So this leaves us with some ideas and opportunities. Harvest Moon is a sub-business of the Blue Moon Diner. They do catering for events, and a lot of you may have heard of Harvest Moon Catering. They offer some local menu options in their service, and we thought that that might be an idea to combine ordering forces with Harvest Moon so that they could purchase more local food at a lower price. And maybe this could be done with other restaurants as well. Small restaurants could team up with each other to purchase local foods in larger quantities to get better deals. The second idea we had was a CSA for restaurants. Many farms offer CSAs for people, and it might be an interesting opportunity for restaurants to also participate in a CSA. The restaurant staff could go out to the farm to get a better understanding about where the food that they were serving would come from, and it would also give the restaurants a guaranteed weekly delivery of local fresh produce. The picture that you see is of a garden space in the back of Blue Moon Diner. This is a perfect opportunity for growing some local vegetables. Right next to the picture, if you ever go to the diner, you can also see that there's a big grassy area, and we also had an idea of installing an extra raised bed in this particular spot to sort of create an urban farm behind the restaurant so that they could grow local veggies and tomatoes and herbs. Inside the diner, there's several boards, if you've ever been in there, that advertise local music venues and local art exhibits. We could also do a local food board that could help advertise what local food was available and give some added information about local farms in the area. We also thought of farmer-specific contracting, which I think has already been mentioned today, where a restaurant would buy, say, we agree to purchase produce from you for X number of weeks at this price. That locks in their produce delivery, and it also locks in a good price. And we feel that events like this and local news generating education to the general public is really needed about what local foods means to our economy and to our environment.
Hi there. My name is Jonathan Coble. I'm tied up in the mic. My group mates throughout this project were Alexander Rosas in the back and Clarice Susky. And we looked at Chipotle as an example of a national food chain and how it affects our community food system. The first thing we wanted to do was define a unit of analysis that everyone could understand. So we chose what we call their visual menu. You can walk into the Chipotle in Charlottesville or anywhere else in the country, and what you see on the bottom of the screen is what you'll see in front of you. So then we wanted to figure out what was in each container, where did it come from, and anything else we could find. We also knew going in that part of their product line, particularly their pork or their carnitas, was coming from Polyface Farms in Swope, Virginia, which is about 50 miles away. So we wanted to figure out how that was going to affect Chipotle, how that was going to affect Polyface Farms, and the community as a whole. And then lastly, we wanted to go a little further and see how far all this food was traveling, as many of the other groups have done.
To accumulate information about the food inputs at Chipotle and to better understand their mission and their goals, we spoke with several locally affiliated representatives from the Charlottesville Chipotle. We also conducted a survey of over 150 Charlottesvillians to understand what their opinion was on Chipotle's local initiative. Most notably, over 75% of the people surveyed were interested in seeing more local ingredients on the menu.
So apart from the local impression, what else do we find? Well, early on, we found that there's this program within Chipotle called Food with Integrity, and it extended throughout our research. This is a program, it's corporation-wide, and it intends to have the freshest, most natural foods at any given time, at any given location, on the menu. The Charlottesville location has taken this a little farther. Obviously, they've worked with Polyface to get the local pork into their menu. You can see by the graph on the right-hand side that pork, by far, has the lowest food mileage as compared to something like, say, avocados, which can come as far away, or can come from Chile, which is almost 3,500 miles away. And also Chipotle is sort of a, Polyface is a different case because they can overcome the supply problems that previous groups have mentioned. They can provide 8 hogs per week to Chipotle. That's 16 hams and shoulders. That's a lot of pork. Not all local farmers can consistently provide that type of supply. And that's sort of indicative of the red tape within corporate restaurants, is that you've got the supply and you've got this quality issue that's standard throughout the country and throughout all the restaurants. And so how do farmers and restaurants work together to meet that need? And then quickly, I could spend all day talking about this. I'd love to. We have 5 minutes. So we found that on average, our calculation methodology was a little imperfect. As the last group found, it's coming from Michigan, not from a specific town in Michigan. So there was a lot of guessing. But the average food mileage per input is about 1,400 miles. And in the perspective of fuel prices, diesel's about $4 per gallon, and the average fuel efficiency for a 5-axle tractor trailer is about 4 to 6 miles per gallon. So that means the cost of fuel per input is roughly $1,100. And granted, that cost will be defrayed if it's shipped in bulk and all that, but it's still a sizable consideration. So along the way, we ran into a few challenges. Actually, our relationship that we developed with the local Chipotle and with Polyface Farm was great. They gave us all the information we needed. We had a couple problems contacting corporate representatives higher up on the ladder just to get a better idea of what the whole corporation thinks about this particular outpost location. And then we had the challenge of approaching this objectively. We all have feelings about corporations and about local food, and so how do we synthesize those? And then Chipotle's challenges in all this, well, it's been mentioned today a lot. They're general concerns. There are some food safety regulations that discriminate against small-scale farmers. If you're from Charlottesville and you read the paper, you know all about this. And that said, not only does it hurt the farmers, but it also hurts restaurants that would like to bring this food onto their menus. Another thing for Chipotle, they want to deal with as few suppliers as possible. With Polyface, they go to Joel Salatin, they say, we want this pork, and he brings them the pork. That's all there is. There's not 50 faces, there's one. It's kind of ironic, Polyface smell. But in any case, this is where something like a food co-op that Fania and Meg mentioned might work to bring more products together. And then finally, the pricing point. These burritos range from $6 to $8, and so how does slightly pricier local food maintain that price point?
And finally, some opportunities that we were looking at. This has been mentioned like many things before, but the idea of having some sort of farmers co-op in which farmers could bring their produce or their livestock to a centralized location in which larger corporations could buy, in therefore minimizing the number of suppliers and also maximizing efficiency for restaurants or other businesses. We also thought that Chipotle's local initiative could be a catalyst for change in the way that local or large-scale businesses buy their ingredients, or food businesses buy their ingredients. Big business buying locally would benefit local farmers by securing a market for their goods, and benefit consumers by driving down the price because higher demand would benefit everyone. And we thought that this change could make fast food healthy and local food too. Thank you. You guys plan to work with me.
Good afternoon. My name is Linda Bartusiak, and this is my partner, Lara Sparks, and we looked at university dining services. The title of our presentation is Looking at How We Feed Ourselves and How Far We've Come, not only in a progress standpoint, but from a food miles standpoint as well. The project goals that we had were to look at Newcomb Dining Hall, which, if you're not familiar with UVA, is one of the most trafficked dining halls on grounds. It's popular among first years. It's popular among upperclassmen. We also wanted to look into the nutritional effects that dining hall food at Newcomb Hall had on the student population, since for many of them, that's their sole food source. They eat most or all of their meals at the dining hall. And we also wanted to look at how university dining can contribute and play a role in the local food movement. Our methodology was fairly simple. We picked a meal at Newcomb Hall at lunchtime, and this was what was being served in one of the rooms. We also analyzed this by interviewing Linda Fanning of UVA Health Services, Brent Berenger from UVA Dining, and we also made a lot of phone calls to Sysco and Aramark, which are two industrial food suppliers that UVA Dining utilizes. We also did a lot of legwork looking at websites and just trying to figure out where all this food came from. So here are the results of all those phone calls and interviews. Sysco and Aramark were helpful to a point. They were willing to tell us where things were distributed out of, but since we ourselves were not actual account holders, they were unwilling to give us much more information than that. But we were actually surprised with our results, even though they wouldn't give us that information. We actually expected a lot of the food to come from farther away, thinking about how it is an industrial food system. But the farthest thing came from California, and the only international thing in this particular meal that we chose anyway was from Mexico. It was some peppers that went in the salsa that went with the chicken quesadilla. So, but 80% of the UVA dining food comes from Sysco. So when you're looking at how UVA can play a role in the local food market, at least currently, that's kind of a 20% range that you're looking at, and probably even lower. But we did find it encouraging that when sustainable or local produce is available, it's the policy of Sysco and Aramark to choose that food. So I think that's how you get a lot of this cluster in Virginia. A lot of that was produce, like fresh vegetables, and surprisingly, a lot of it was dairy products, like the cheese and the sour cream. Then our other finding about the nutrition was that UVA considers this one of their top priorities. They understand their role in feeding the students. All of the food was very nutritious. They have some great efforts underway to educate the students about which foods are nutritious, but they also do their best not to push it in people's faces as well. For this particular meal that we looked at, we found that there was approximately 7,700 food miles on the meal.
All right, so moving on to challenges. Well, for one thing, it's the size of the market, and realistically, if UVA Dining were to try to go all local, they would exhaust the local market and leave nothing left for everyone else. I mean, the market may be non-existent because it would be all going to students, which I know not everyone here would appreciate. And so that's one challenge. And furthermore, they have very unique nutritional needs because some students are finicky about what they eat, and they have to deal with athletes and allergies and eating disorders and all other sorts of special needs, so they need to make sure that they have a lot of options. And if some students will only eat strawberries as a fruit source, then they need to make sure they have them to keep the student body as healthy as possible while they're trying to learn to live on their own. And also, they need to involve an industrial food distributor in order to limit the number of inputs, because just from an efficiency standpoint, it's difficult to have lots of local farms where you have to go out and it would be difficult to have a bunch of trucks coming in every day, whereas they can right now just have the one truck and one supplier. And also, per Aramark standards, the local farms that they have to deal with need to have at least $5 million in liability insurance, and not everyone can afford that. But so for future implications, we were looking at the university as a predictable source of demand. For example, with their capital campaign, they declared that they were going to raise a certain amount of money, and they're well on their way in doing that. So we were thinking that if they were to announce that they were going to, by 2020, have 50% of their sources from local sources, then the market would expand and sort of allot for that. And also there are students as the drivers of change. Just in today's Cavalier Daily, right here, they had an article about Runk Dining Hall is now harvesting a student herb and vegetable garden. And additionally, there is a student initiative called Green Dining right now. And last night, they even held a sustainable and local food and organic food dinner at Newcomb Dining Hall. So there are a lot of initiatives. And as long as UVA pays attention to the wants of the students, and UVA Dining is very willing to work with them, then it's looking positive. And also, we were thinking that maybe the university, given the right amount of funding, could help the local farmers with the liability insurance, and that may take care of some of those issues. So yeah, that's what we got.
All right, well, we're almost done, but before we're done, we should look at JABA, which is Jefferson Area Board of Aging. My name is Megan Bucknam, and this is my friend and partner, Regine Kennedy. And we wanted to evaluate the challenges as well as the opportunities for providing local food for a specialized population. So we had several goals, the first of which is to really determine the environmental cost of a meal. It's easy to find an economic cost of what the food is, but we wanted to quantify this environmental cost with a currency value so we could understand really the environmental impact that traveling food all over the country has. Second, JABA already has a local food initiative, and they've compiled their own board for it, and they're doing a lot of really great things. We just hope that our project could hopefully provide more information of how to increase their proposed 25% of every meal to be local to maybe help them increase that percentage. And lastly, we wanted to provide these concrete findings so that JABA could later take advantage of any grants that would be available to assist them financially into making all of their meals locally sourced. We had several research methods for coming to all of these goals. The first being that we worked with the Hillsdale Center, and they serve one hot meal for all of their clients a day, and that's usually around 40 meals. So we selected one of their favorite menu items, which you'll see later, and we wanted to analyze how they're currently supplying all this food. We wanted to do this again from an economic perspective of just how much is the actual food. And then we came up with that currency value by using the IRS standard for 48.5 cents per mile, which is the standard reimbursement for any travel. Third, we wanted to look at any local food opportunities. We really wanted to research these so that we could bring those back to JABA. We wanted to, again, attach the food costs as well as the food miles at the same rate. And then with the local system, we wanted to make sure we included any additional costs that would be taken in and any additional benefits. And then lastly, we wanted to compare these two food systems. So our key findings for the current system, JABA uses U.S. Foods as their distributor, and the closest U.S. Foods distribution center is in Roanoke, Virginia. So that is what that little truck is. JABA is behind that. It's the purple one. And then all of the yellow place markers that you see are processing plants that they use. So from Judy Berger, I received an invoice of all of the product codes of this meal that you see in the legend. And then I became a food detective, calling US Foods, trying to find out where, what companies they use and where it was shipped to Roanoke. So after I had that information, I then had to start calling these companies and finding out if they knew where the food was grown. And this is where, like many other projects we just have heard, you hit a brick wall. But a lot of the people that I spoke with were able to provide me with kind of regions of where the food probably was coming from. So on this map, each line represents when the food was traveling. And each kind of geometric block represents a potential growing area that the food came from. Now, the yellow one that leads in Arkansas, that was Tyson Chicken. And Tyson's was not able to provide me of where the chicken was first hatched and grown or where it was processed. So this dot is just an average of the 12 chicken processing plants that are in Arkansas. And we use this averaging system to find out a lot of these different distances. For instance, North Dakota, the Dakota pasta growers, they buy most of their wheat from North Dakota. So we took an average of the furthest distance from each corner of the state to the processing plant. Now, when we analyze all this data, we find that for 40 meals of this specific menu, the food costs are $83.92. But if we take that extrapolated value of the food mile reimbursement, we come to a total of $4,110. And if we really wanted to analyze this environmentally, we should really offset the carbon. So that means that every time this meal is served, we'd need to add another $13.53 to justify the 8,302 food miles that it took to reach all of these different sources to the plates in Java.
Next, we took a look at the same meal from local sources. As you can see, the food costs go up slightly, but the food miles go down significantly. So we have a total overall cost for the same meal from local sources of about $350. And you can also see that the map is a much tighter focus. And I've included some of the places that we use to get some prices for local food. In addition to just the food, though, we need to take into account the different costs that are going to be necessary to implement a comprehensive program. For example, we would need to, at Java, increase the size of the kitchen, to have more facilities available for preparing the food. In addition, we'd have to have more staff, either to cook the food, to prepare the food, and more volunteers to help with those costs as well. So along with the food costs, the environmental costs, there are social costs, but there are also the social benefits of Java being an employer and, again, having this greater connection with the community and their suppliers. Some of the challenges are challenges that we've heard throughout the presentations before. The difficulty in tracking food through the multiple companies and regions of the country. Also finding fresh local substitutes for some of the food. Pears, for example, are not available all year round in Virginia, but they are available some of the year. Java has done a great job in their team of nutritionists to accommodate the preferences, the dietary restrictions, and the likelihood that their clients are going to enjoy the meals. And so it was important for us to be able to source the menus that they've created to create the local sources. And again, we ran into challenges of providing food that meets state and federal food regulations. Some of the ideas and opportunities that we came up with. First of all, Java is very dedicated to incorporating fresh local food into their network. They do this by, as Megan mentioned, they have created a community food system project advisory board, and they're connecting with members of the community that can help support their goal at different levels. Additionally, they have a greenhouse on grounds that they can grow some lettuces and some herbs as well to use. And they're talking about how they can either can or preserve food when it's fresh in the summer and in the spring so that they can use it in the winter. So that's kind of an exciting thing to do. And also, we want to provide this information to other local institutions for duplication. We don't want this knowledge all to be lost or to be hoarded, but to be shared with other institutions like the Blue Ridge Area Food Bank or schools and things like that. And we like to encourage our local legislators to change regulations to help accommodate the local food system whenever possible. With that, we're moving on to
Blue Ridge. Good afternoon, everybody. Thanks for bearing with us this far. My name is Lauren, and this is my partner, Ben. And for our project, we looked into the Blue Ridge Area Food Bank, and within the context of the local community or the local food system and the local community. Okay, we had two objectives for this project. The first was to investigate the Blue Ridge Area Food Bank system. That included the funding that went into the food bank, the intake, which meant the sources of food and where exactly they came from, so that's where our tracing was, and then the distribution from the food bank itself out to the 25 counties and 9 cities that it reaches in Virginia. Then all of this helped us to look into including the local food in or local food inputs into that system, which was really the exciting part of our project and what we focused on. The methodology that we used to trace the foods that went into the food bank back were based on a typical distribution to a family of four from one of the local agencies in the Thomas Jefferson area once a month. This distribution was essentially what you see on the right there. Four bags of product that came from the USDA to the food bank and was allocated to this church where we which works with the food bank, the Holy Comforter Catholic Church in Charlottesville, as well as what you can see in the back on the lower picture, which is a supplemental bag of food that came from food drives and also products that the church bought to give out to the recipients. So essentially what we found in the bags were these different categories of food. We were impressed by how everyone at the food bank emphasizes that they try to provide nutritional and balanced food. So, however, these were often non-perishables, highly processed foods, as you can see. Mostly what we found were grains, vegetables, fruit, meat, a lot of prepared goods, and then a few snacks included. Our findings were linked to many challenges in the food bank. As you can see by the picture on the right, this provides a pretty clear overview of where the funding fits in. The food comes from different sources, as we'll get into nationally, and then it comes into one central distribution center and then is distributed among those 25 counties in Virginia. But we found that it was very difficult, as many of the other groups noted, to trace the food due to these strict non-disclosure policies. We were making the phone calls, but since the products were coming from companies such as Kellogg's, Campbell's, I mean, we ran into a brick wall pretty quickly. So the furthest we could trace was back to processing plants. However, one of our one retailer that I spoke to said that he hopes that these laws, especially for labeling, would change in the near future because he received a total of, I think, or an average of 100 calls a week from concerned consumers about where exactly their food is coming from. Additionally, as I just mentioned, we saw the importance of non-perishables. And while these foods are extremely cost-effective and easy to store and easy to travel with, there are health implications to that and also take away from a potential link that the food bank could have with the local community.
Okay, so moving on to some maps that we developed. This is the local Blue Ridge Area Food Bank System map as far as state and Charlottesville region local goes. For the state, we have the Blue Ridge Area Food Bank, which is located right here. It has four branch locations, I should say. This is Verona, Virginia. This is one up in Winchester, one down in Lynchburg, and then here we are in Charlottesville in the Thomas Jefferson area branch. We have the shortest driving distance, 44 miles, well, not counting Verona because they're right there at the headquarters. But when the USDA program food comes to the Blue Ridge Area Food Bank in Verona, that's its starting location. Well, that's what we could consider a starting location. So if we're receiving food, it's traveling 44 miles just to get to the Thomas Jefferson Area Food Bank over on Harris Street. So on the area scale, Thomas Jefferson area scale, obviously it's a lot more local. Here's Harris Street right here in the food bank. Just for reference, Holy Comforter is down here at 0.9 miles. And then the City Market, also we're going to talk about City Market implications, is right here, and it's 1.2 miles. So obviously a negligible distance within Charlottesville, but again, we'll get into the transportation needs of local food are different than the transportation needs of the America's Second Harvest USDA foods because of their perishable nature. And here's just a quick picture of the national scale from what we could find. Again, we could get as close as states here for where the origins were, and a lot of these turned out to be processing plants or distributors, not exactly where the food originated from. This is largely the USDA product that comes into the Blue Ridge Area Food Bank. The product that they receive from the USDA is very variable. It's kind of whatever is cheapest at the time and what they can get the most of. They did tell us that they would kind of pick and choose to try to provide a healthy balance, but if they can get a lot of something for a low cost and give it out in higher quantities to their customers, then they're going to do that. So again, it's kind of the Mid-Atlantic, Midwest region. We have Fiji over here for some tuna. So that's not so close, but we were encouraged, I guess, in this sense. This is fairly local probably by some standards. But anyway, this is just showing you that USDA product is traveling a lot further. And then ideas we had for change. One thought we had was a community kitchen and the ability of a community kitchen to circumvent some of these policies that prohibit farmers from selling directly to the food bank, because the food bank does have policies about what they can and cannot give out to consumers. And also, it had been discussed earlier that a community kitchen could be the potential to have value-added products created. Either food bank users or farmers or just local people could use this community kitchen to create products and keep this money within the community, provide jobs, and also provide food to the community. And then sourcing more locally, this is kind of the most exciting part of our project, I would say. A possible partnership with Market Central, which is a nonprofit group that works with City Market cooperation between past vendors, local vendors, and just interested community members in City Market, and they work to better City Market. But a partnership with them to offer low-cost goods directly to the food bank or the agency organizations like Holy Comforter. The potential there is very great. We just actually sat down yesterday morning with the food security specialist with Thomas Jefferson Area Food Bank and then Paul Brandt, who is a representative from Market Central. And they were both very encouraged and said this is something that can happen from this season. Which would be incredible. What this would look like would be market producers at the end of the Saturday selling session would drop off their extra produce, the perishable produce, and it would be picked up by either a Thomas Jefferson Area Food Bank representative or a representative of the agency organizations. We've been told that the Area Food Bank has the capacity to store these sorts of things. They have an industrial freezer to keep things for a few days at least, and they also have a refrigerated truck for transport. Obviously, they're transporting 1-point-something miles, but still, just the refrigeration aspect is extremely important, especially when produce has been sitting out all morning. But exciting potential and something that we're looking forward to seeing grow.
We need to switch to PowerPoint for this one real quickly, but just while we're in the process of doing that, I want to point out that the person I've been talking about the whole time, Harold, is in the back, and he wanted me to point out that his name is spelled wrong in the program. There's two L's in it, so
it's Foley with two L's. And so many of you probably know in Charlottesville right now, a quarter of the population lives below the poverty line. So before we talk about the local food system in like a very holistic manner, looking at all of it, we need to kind of like see what the reality of local food and nutritious food is in the low-income context. So I was Harold was amazing, and I want to thank him for being willing and answering all of our questions about his experiences with food. So our goals for this project were, number one, to do exactly what I just said, put a different perspective on our food, which is talking about in the low-income context. And we want to provide feedback for people in this room and the Charlottesville community based on the experiences of a low-income family. So our methodology was, first and foremost, we had frequent discussions with the Foleys. Second, we gave them a food log and tracked what they did for what they ate for a week. There's seven members in this family, and we just saw all the stuff that they ate in a week, and we kind of like roughly evaluated on nutrition. And it was not very nutritious, and we'll get to why that is in a minute. We also went grocery shopping with them, with the family. This is a picture from Kroger where most of their grocery shopping is done. And this is another picture of them grocery shopping. And along with that, we did some cost comparisons. And this is really interesting because right next to each other, you have Kroger brand and you have Apple Jack's brand. And this isn't even comparing nutritious to non-nutritious food. This is just comparing brand names that most of us are familiar with to generic brands. And it's double the price when you talk about Apple Jack's, which is what most of us are familiar with. Then we talk about some nutritious food versus non-nutritious food. This is the Tyson chicken, which, as we know, based on a previous presentation, we have no clue where it comes from. It's 99 cents per pound is the unit price. You compare that to what they sell at Whole Foods, which is the organic, hormone-free variety of the exact same thing. It is $7.99 per unit price. Doesn't take a lot of math to realize that's a huge difference. So, and also talking about the local food context, this is just to give you an idea of what we're looking at. The vast majority of the food we couldn't trace past Kroger. Kroger is distribution headquarters. It's in Cincinnati. And unless Cincinnati is the world's biggest farm, then it comes from somewhere besides Cincinnati. So I've never been there before. Maybe someone can tell me that that actually is a huge farm. So coming from this, some of our key findings were, first and foremost, it was these people living in, Harold knows, he knows what local food is, he knows what nutritious food is, he knows the advantages of it, but he doesn't eat it. A lot of that is because there is tons of availability of food in Charlottesville. One of the things he specifically told me was that nobody in Charlottesville starves. There's always food available, but there's no nutritious food available. You go to the food banks, kind of some of the stuff Ben was talking about. You go to some of the organizations around town like Loaves and Fishes that provide some of the food for people that have to can't afford all their food. It's not nutritious. They'll be the first people to admit it. And some of the people in the Foley family, one of them is diabetic. And we asked him if he eats what he thinks is a healthy diabetic diet. And he said no. And we asked him why. And specifically said, because eating a healthy diet is unaffordable. It is inaccessible on the income level that he has. This is something, remember, a quarter of our population deals with this every single day. And there's a very strong desire for programs to provide fresh vegetables. Fresh vegetables are something that came over and over and over in our community. They're not eating them, not because there's not a lack of a desire. They really want it. It's just, like I said, currently, it's completely inaccessible to these people. So, and kind of to talk about addressing kind of our methodology a little bit, some challenges and questions that we had lingering after this project. Number one is, what do other families experience? Our project was exclusively looking at the experience of the Foley family. So we can't really generalize it to, we can't at all generalize it to all the entire low-income context, but some of the experiences are probably remarkably similar in other families. And some other issues that influence food housing. Like Harold said, people in Charlottesville don't usually starve, but there's a lot of people homeless. Homelessness is rising here. And stress associated to working two or three jobs, that's something that people living in low-income housing deal with on a daily basis. And that has huge implications on your food decisions, where you get food from, and that needs to be considered when talking about food. And just kind of like a basic methodology question, anytime that you ask questions to somebody, who's asking the questions has huge implications on what answers you get. So wondering how our presence influenced the Foley's decisions. And so coming out of this, we have some ideas and opportunities for change. There's three ones. First, make nutritious and local food available in existing stores where people do their shopping. And of course, this is much easier said than done. But if food's available, like you go to Kroger, there's nothing local there. And that's the most affordable store in Charlottesville right now. And if somehow we can get nutritious food there, they'll afford it. Harold told me if there's local food, if there's organic food in the places that he's able to shop at, he'll buy it. But right now it doesn't exist there. And then engage low-income communities with the locals' farmers market. An idea that came from Harold was that putting food stamps in at the farmers market, making that an option for people there. People will go if they can afford it, same thing. But right now, there's no opportunity to do that. And engaging people in the process of growing food and distributing their own food. QCC, Quality Community Council, as many probably know, has a urban farm project right now that is very successful and continuing that process, expanding it to new locations. Right now it's only at 6th Street and Friendship Court, and that's only two of the public housing facilities here in the city. And if we can expand that to other places, that'll help a lot of people. And that's all.
That's great. We are now, where's our podcast guy? Do we need to keep using this?
I think that's the only way they're going to
Okay.
Report.
Well, what we're going to do then is we're open for questions, and the students can, any of the students' projects are open for questions, and what we'll do is try and repeat them. It's a little tedious, but we'll repeat the question and then ask the students to come up and... Yes, yes, and can you say, introduce yourself, if you could, stand up.
My question has to do with a food bank, and one of the solutions offered was to collect the food after the Charlottesville City Market on Saturday at the end. And my understanding is that food goes for Food Not Bombs, which is already making food for low-income families.
Okay, food bank team.
Should we stand up?
Yeah.
Okay. I've actually been to Food Not Bombs before and seen what they do, and they do great work in Charlottesville. As far as I understand and what we talked about with Paul, there is still extra product that would be available to the food bank. I know that in the past they've worked with the Salvation Army and other organizations, but he didn't mention anything about Food Not Bombs. I certainly wouldn't want to step on their toes for this, but I'm not exactly sure. We haven't really heard anything about that, but my understanding is that there would still be food to take to the food bank.
I could lend you a little information about that. My name is Tom Timmerman. I'm with the I'm just actually just an individual that has interest in our environment and our community here.
Hello. And I'm also on the board of directors for the Blue Ridge Area Food Bank, and you guys did a great job of representing them. But one of the problems that we have in terms of accepting food, again, I'm not full-time, I'm just a volunteer on the board, is to be able to get the perishable foods into the hands of the agencies on a timely basis. And that's very difficult when you're feeding, in our case, about 120,000 people over a very, very large territory. So it's a great idea, and we really need to hang in there with that idea if there are foods that are in surplus. But it's a tremendous need. And the food bank just has a lot of arms and legs due to the 9 cities, as you mentioned, 25 counties stretching from Loudoun down to Roanoke, almost to Richmond. But we're gonna definitely take advantage of that. And I'm very happy that I learned a little bit about it. So thank you.
Okay, thanks. I think there was a hand over here, and then we'll go back. Was there a hand over? I think this, yeah. And stand and introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Francesco de Paris. The question I have is for the groups that did interviews on the farms. Fall farm teams come up. If you could talk about the sustainable farming practices that you saw on the farm. I'm familiar with what Polyface does in terms of incorporating all the animals' lives into their own lives, you know, to have sustainable practice. So what did you see that was interesting or that is different from, I guess, an industrial farm perspective?
Great, thank you.
Okay, so this is a great question. So you asked what is done as far as sustainability goes on these farms versus industrial farms. For one, I guess maybe split this up, kind of go with animals and land. In our case, since we worked on a farm that had sheep, goats, and cattle, the animals, in that perspective, the animals that Susan has picked are both She picked them both for their robustness to disease, so they don't need a lot of medicine and a lot of things like that, but also how they do with the climate. So she's picked kind of the best animals for this area, so kind of doing that genetically. Also, what they're fed. They're fed grass, which is what these animals normally eat, rather than animals which are kept on feedlots and fed corn instead of some kind of foliage and like that. As far as the land goes, Susan has fenced off all her waterways, and her animals are not allowed to go in those waterways. So after you remember, my last shot was of her pond. She has a nice little creek that runs into this huge pond. So she's taken that out of, I guess, pasture that some farms might not do. She also rotationally grazes so that her land's allowed to rest and recuperate, so that, manure is not, there's not a huge toxic buildup of nitrogen in one particular place. Also, she has 60 acres that's still in forest, so that's one way to protect the watershed from sedimentation and things like that. Maybe other farmers don't necessarily do, for whatever reason. So, do you want to talk about roundabout?
And
another microphone here too.
Great. For roundabout, they're not officially organic certified, but they do do their best to follow organic practices, although they don't have the official certification. Other than that, I don't know a lot of the specifics. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Does it? And then I think we had Judy. Can you come up here?
I'm Judy Berger with JABA. I just wanted to make a comment regarding the excess of produce and product after the farmers market. I think as you find that more restaurants and organizations like JABA are purchasing meals, rather food directly from farmers, that we will develop relationships with them, that we will buy what's left over from them at the farmers market. And don't get me wrong, it's not that we think that, we certainly don't think the food shouldn't be donated by any means, but we're also very much in favor of keeping the farmers in business. So if they can get a little bit of money for that leftover produce, we want to make sure they get that money.
Other comments or questions from people?
Was this first?
Okay, first and then.
All right, sure. I'm Ann Malik, and I wanted to know what sort of hoops are required to get the food stamps at the farmers market.
Can anybody answer that?
I can speak a little bit to that.
Okay.
And can you introduce yourself?
I'm Sue Moffitt with the Charlottesville Department of Social Services, and interestingly, I think as a result of last year's class, we have kind of continually been working on that. Our biggest hurdle right now is technology, because food stamps in our state is a web-based product, and that's not available at the city market. We're getting closer. We've got another group of folks who are going to be working on it over the summer for us, and we're still hopeful that that will be soon, but right now it's not available.
Cat 5 line to the farmers market, and then you have your
web,
right?
Okay, so we need internet at the farmers market, I think somebody was saying.
All right, you need to come forward.
All right. My name is Stefan Yerka. This is a question for some of the groups that spoke earlier about Feast, Blue Moon Diner, Chipotle, talking a lot about food miles. I think there's probably a lot of other factors besides just transportation that goes into the carbon emissions. So I was wondering if you guys thought at all about, fertilizer inputs and, other kinds of factors like that that could affect the carbon emissions. So that, for example, if a product is grown in North Dakota where soils are really fertile, it's great. You don't need to put in a lot of fertilizer. It might actually have lower carbon emissions than something coming from Virginia, for example, that has crappy soils. You need a lot of fertilizer. Just something to think about.
Okay, anyone want to take a crack at that?
Okay.
I don't think that the scope of this project allowed us to get into that so much. I wish it had, but it was a semester project, and we actually made a decision in class on one of the first days, are we going to go for the for the primary inputs, or are we going to go secondary and tertiary? And it just came to be that for all of our groups, once we selected a unit, that while we would have liked to have gone a little further down that road, it just didn't fit into the scope of the project. So I acknowledge that, and I would, even down to the facilities that cook the food? Are they doing what they can to minimize energy use and just little things like that? So I think if we were to take our projects further, that would probably be what's next, right?
Okay. All right. Three more hands up.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Tom Olivier, and I just have a question. The group that spoke on Feast mentioned a community food center, which is a concept I think I heard last year in this session, but I'd be very interested to know a little more about the sort of the status of that idea.
Okay. So do you want to take a crack?
Well, the status of that idea is that Kate is still working on it. We're trying to help her by doing some research as to possible locations, because I guess part of the idea is if we could keep the facility as close to town as possible, that would cut down on the food miles issue. But Kate, do you want to speak? I don't want to put you on the spot.
Right now, the Community Food Center is a one sheet that's kind of been shopped around to institutions, including JABA and Martha Jefferson and UVA, and we're kind of in the listening phase, getting feedback from farmers and institutions about what is needed. I brought a pile of the one sheets that I'd be happy to hand out, and you can also get to me at kate@feastvirginia.com if you have more questions. But at this point, we're looking for community support. We are going to try and take in everybody's opinions and really create a center that's going to help farmers be able to have control of their value-added products while also being able to bring more food to the institutions, chopping and freezing. And I think the more we hear from different people, the more this is expanding in scope.
There was an Eat Local little committee that was looking at this also. Are you talking to them at all? Or is it a different concept?
I'm not sure if that group has connected. I mean, JABA brought together...
About 2 weeks ago, JABA brought together a huge group of really knowledgeable people, and JABA is working, has a great proposal that also includes the idea of this food center. So I think... there are a lot of, and just as this information has leaked, I've been getting emails from community members that say, I want to do whatever I can to make this happen and to help. So, you know, as much, as many people that want to get involved, you know, we're kind of sifting through how do we logistically make this happen. We need to talk about is it going to be community or government supported? You know, I spoke today with Economic Development Board bringing to my attention sewage lines and you know, are you going to build this? Is there going to be enough water? And so there's many different details that need to be hammered out. But, you know, as far as I'm concerned and as far as a lot of people are concerned, we really want this to be a 2 to 3 year project. We don't want this to kind of sit in a feasibility idea for 10 years. So as much proactiveness as can happen, you know, I think everybody that's on board helps. So anything you guys can offer to help, it's open. It's an open idea.
And Kate, can you put your one sheets out somewhere where people can get them? And I'd also like to say, take this opportunity, thank you for your donation of food that we're enjoying in the back. Thank you. Okay, there were two other hands back here. Yeah.
Come. Thanks.
This is this part.
Thank you. My name's Matt Rails. I work at Polyface Farm. It's really great to be here. I was an apprentice for a year. I'm now in kind of mid-level management. I also do farm tours, so if anyone wants to come see where their carnitas come from, you're welcome to. I wanted to touch on the question about carbon emissions. This is really interesting in the food system that we have today. A lot of people are asking themselves, you know, what kind of food production doesn't spew carbon into the atmosphere? Well, I'm going to talk a little bit about what we do just for a minute. I'll keep it brief. But we practice what's called mob stocking, lignified solar conversion, sequestration, fertilization. And I'm not going to try to repeat it a second time. We haven't come up with an acronym, and yes, that's a true blue Joel Salatin right there. What we do is we bunch our cows up like the bison when we run them. We're running them on about 100 acres at the home farm, and we're renting 700 acres of pasture spread over about 3 farms. We have gone from 1 to 8% organic matter in the 40 or so years that we've been grazing at the farm since Joel's dad bought the farm in around 1961. If you go to the EPA website, they tell you about what the average, you know, sedan will put out in a given year. Well, we've sequestered on those 100 acres of pasture, this is excluding the rental properties, we've sequestered the equivalent of the annual emissions of 40,000 cars with cows. That's a big deal when the UN's blaming cows for melting the Arctic. you know, it's important that we ask ourselves, beyond just the transportation aspect, how we eat influences the kind of carbon we sequester. So aside from that, we double the production of our land twofold once a year without planting a seed or putting down one bag of fertilizer. Again, with cows, pigs, chickens, the whole gamut. Our farm averages about 400 cow days per acre, while our neighbors average about 75. That's the amount of biomass, grass growing, carbon sequestering, solar converting material that's present there. And I'll close this with another kind of radical idea for everybody, which is we remain about a half of a percentage of the food system still, our local artisanal production models, which are wonderful and fantastic, and but I think we need to ramp it up a little bit. And I think our question needs to become, where do we go from here with regards to our resources, which are livestock and land? It's everywhere. It's just in the wrong hands. And I think if we start to realize the potential of the resources that we have at hand, and we can get the U.S. duh out of the way, we've got a lot of potential. And I was really thrilled with the Chipotle presentation that illustrated our relationship, and I think it's, you know, a good starting point. So I'll turn it back over. But
get lots of copies of Joel's new book.
Hi, my name is Joe Cloud. I'm just recently moved to the area from Seattle, and I just have a couple comments I wanted to make. And first, I just wanted to commend you on the diversity of all the food, the elements of the local food system that y'all chose. And I'd like to make comments on two of them, one which you did choose and one which you didn't. And I think it would, the one that you didn't, that might have been a good one to study, is looking at local school systems, not at the university level, but elementary, junior, and high school. And I know we've done a lot of work out in the state of Washington with that. I think the governor just signed into law just a few weeks ago some legislation, and you were talking about the regulations that could be changed to address this sort of thing. One of the changes that they made was that local school systems are no longer required to choose by cost alone. In other words, local food, as you know, is more expensive, but their hands were tied. They were required to choose the low cost bid. They have other things that they can factor in that allows them to do that. So they've got some discretion. And I think the second one was the last one, the Foley family, and that is just a huge problem in America for low income. You cannot get good food at low cost. It's very difficult to do that when you're in an urban setting. I know in Seattle, I think it's pretty typical, I'm not going to say universal, but across the very common in the farmers markets that you can use food stamps. So I think it is just a technological fix to overcome that. Another thing in the city of Seattle is that we have an incredible community garden system. I think they've got close to 140 or 150 local community gardens just in the city alone. They specifically set out to target low-income neighborhoods and immigrant neighborhoods, and they can't keep enough gardens in there, and the city provides the water, the city provides tools to break the ground and that sort of thing, and then the users take it from there. So,
yeah. Great, super, thanks. I want to say while
you want to add on to that?
Well, no, I was thinking of Ann Bedarfo here because the last year's class actually looked at farm to school. And there has been a task force, legislatively created task force, right here in the state. I guess they've reported at this point.
It's out, and
there is progress being made. Do you want to say something about that? Because that was the focus of your work in last year's class, if I'm remembering correctly.
I'll just mention, it's like choke somebody here. Yeah, last year's class actually worked on farm-to-school project, trying to hook up Stone Robinson Elementary School with a local certified organic farm that's actually quite close, and the name's escaping me right now. Appalachia Star, right?
Yeah.
But the regulation that inhibited that from moving forward was, even though that farm was certified organic, they weren't certified to transport the food, and the school couldn't, they'd take whatever they could get, but they couldn't deal with, you know, going out and getting food. So that's a really good example of one of the regulations that could be looked at and changed. And I know the person who deals with food for county schools is very open to the idea. Yes.
I must say, I had lunch with my daughter today at her elementary school.
I think we'll put you in the queue, Casey.
Oh, you're in the queue.
All right, I think next is this gentleman, then way over there, and then we'll come back to you, Casey. I just want to say, Joe, I live way out in some rural boonies, and I can attest that fresh local food is just as hard to get out in rural areas as it is in urban areas. In fact, maybe even harder. So where's our...
Hello, everybody. I'm Jonathan. I am the general manager of the Chipotle. It was a pleasure, and we are very, very interested in continuing working with everybody that is studying this and, you know, who wants to get more information about it. We're certainly trying to do what we can to be, you know, a part of the change. And it's great to see Polyface represented here. I get to see him once in a week, and it's a real pleasure seeing something come from so close by and making a real big impact. The reason I wanted to actually come up, though, was I wanted to explain a little bit behind the problems of finding out exactly where everything comes from and how that relates to food miles. And I'm actually going to use Nyman Ranch as our example, because basically all of the pork that Chipotle serves throughout the country, over which there was 5 million pounds last year, 100% organically raised, is located in Chicago. And this Nyman Ranch is based on a conglomeration of a whole bunch of little teeny tiny farms where, you know, they'll call up and say, hey, I got 5 pigs for you this week. Well, that'd be a great, you know, addition to what they have to offer for Nyman, but you know they're getting farms with 1 or 2 or 3 chickens a week and all this kind of stuff, and they don't have the quality or the demand or the what am I looking for? The supply amount that that we are looking for. And for example, with Nyman Ranch, everything comes to one place. So it all has to be shipped into the area of Chicago. So there's all the food miles that go from all the little teeny tiny stops that they have to make to get it into one place to actually cook it. And then it's redistributed out from that one location straight out to the restaurants. But that's done actually through another intermediary, which would be the like the way that Chipotle is set up. I can tell you that for every 50 to 100 restaurants, depending on where you are, we each have our own warehouse. So all of it goes to there, and then it gets shipped. You know, once again, it goes somewhere else. So there's a whole lot of shipping that goes into those food miles. Well, being able to work with, you know, Polyface, for example, is the way around that. And yes, it costs us a little bit more, but we don't pass that on to customers because we believe in it. And, you know, we are trying to get to the point of being able to have the amount of all these products that we want to serve. You know, and the fact that there's so many local farmers that want to get in involved in this, and, you know, and they're calling us up saying, hey, can I, you know, give you my 5 chickens that I had this week or whatever. Well, we can't do that. That's just not feasible. But you got to think about who processes your food, who gets it ready to, you know, be served out on, you know, for example, on our line. If you're not talking about raw vegetables, who's doing all the processing? Who's making it ready? Who's making it safe for you to eat? I mean, the reason that, for example, with Polyface, that they can't have these type of services on premises, and they have to ship it somewhere to have it federally inspected and checked and taken care of, is because of the quality, and the government cares about what we're all eating, and that's why the rules are so strict. But because of that, it presents logistical problems, and that's the part that is really tough to get around, and that's the part that, you know, we're trying to work with people as we go through our purchasing with Polyface and with Nyman Ranch and some others that we're trying to work around. And it's not an easy thing. Definitely, the gentleman who's speaking about ramping up everything was certainly right. We got to have more to pick from so that we can get these co-ops to start organizing themselves and really build that infrastructure that it's going to take to get this to a national level. I really enjoyed seeing all the local farms that were presented, and you know, it's a real big challenge when you're talking about a national scale. But we're doing what we can, and we, you know, want everybody to know it's really interesting to go through it. I mean, it took us 17 months, actually, to get the whole process down to the way that we actually cook the carnitas from Polyface on almost a daily basis in our restaurant right now. And that 17 months is just figuring it out, and that's you know, a drop in the bucket. So this is, it takes a long time to get this right. This is not something we can flick a switch and do this overnight, and it takes a lot of effort and on the back end of things. But we're trying to make it happen.
Next time, for the next Chipotle store?
Yes, we're actually expanding it to another store up in the D.C. market, where some of the busiest Chipotles are in the entire country. Here in Charlottesville, we're one of the top 50, which is great, which we get to get all that Polyface out to the customers.
And will you share what you've learned with other fast food chains, or is that going to affect your edge?
Yes and no. Certainly, we're not in this to be the only company or the only group that cares about doing things right and to, you know, get the quality that we hope that everybody can expect to have from Chipotle to other places. We want to get it right before we give all of our information to other people. And since it's so new, we just started in, it was 2002 with the pork and the chicken. And I said the pork is 100% organically raised. The chicken is at 85% right now, and that's 5 years. And that's not too bad for the amount of chicken that we go through. And then in 2003 was when they started the beef, and 50% of that is organically raised and all that. It takes a long time, but we're going to make it happen.
Okay.
So, great. Does anybody ever have any other questions while I'm up here for Chipotle? Anybody? Sure, go ahead.
Is the decision to source locally something that came from above in your organization, or is it simply a devolution of authority that not allows you to make those decisions at the local level?
It was actually started by the founder of the company. His desire, he started Chipotle in 1993, but his desire to expand into doing better for his customers, which where I'm talking about Denver now because that's where it was started, his desire to expand that really filtered throughout the entire company. And that was where the beginning of the Food with Integrity push started. So really, it honestly comes from the top with us. Our relationship with Polyface started from one of our regional directors at this, who's just been moved up to an actually operations director. So he's one of the top, you know, 5 or 10 people in Chipotle, basically in charge of the entire Mid-Atlantic region. Was in the buyers club for Polyface, and he kind of got everything started. He got everything rolling with Polyface locally, and then they started working out the deals, and then that's where that 17-month process started about getting it right and figuring out how much we'd need, how to cook it in the store, and all that. I mean, that's where the rest of that kind of just fell into place. But to answer your question, it basically came from the very top. Okay. Anybody else?
How are the carnitas selling?
They're selling great. We're finding that it's actually a different recipe than that we use for the Polyface as opposed to what we get from Nyman Ranch. One of the reasons is that because of the Polyface, for example, when you move into like a winter type of stage, you get more fat on all the meat. The animals bulk up to prevent, you know, and that just makes sense. Well, when you take it to a bigger place like Nyman Ranch, they have a little bit more control over all that. Well, we get Polyface raw into the store every week, and we take care of searing it, braising it, cooking it, you know, cutting it, shredding it, everything that we need to do to get it ready to eat. And that's kind of what I was talking about the food miles and the actual preparation of it all. But, you know, what going back to your question, though,
yeah.
Does that answer your question?
Well,
I mean, yeah, it is.
A lot of people come in specifically for that menu item?
Yeah, we keep a sign up front right now when we're actually serving that as opposed to the Nyman Ranch. We're just about at the spot where we need to, where we're going to be able to provide 100% Polyface. Like I said, this whole ramping up has been going on for a while. How long is it to turn pigs? Is it six months? Yeah, before hogs are ready to go to market.
We get them at about 50 to 75 pounds.
Okay.
We just buy them as piggies.
Yeah. Yeah, before we see it. So this is, you know, like I said, it's not an overnight thing, but they're selling very well. They taste a little bit different. They're a little bit fattier in their content, which makes them actually taste a little bit better. But we spice them a little bit differently from what Nyman Ranch does. So they actually taste a little bit different than anywhere else. Mm-hmm.
Okay, we're good. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Thank you.
I don't want to keep everyone from munching away longer, keep this going. But two things my name is Casey Williams. Two things I didn't hear mentioned in particular were kind of like the idea of the Nyman Ranch thing, the horse and buggy option, which is a little bit of my understanding is it's a little bit of a middleman, someone who gets the produce from farmers in the valley that are small and don't want to take the trouble of setting up a system for distribution and helps get that to families and sources that are interested in that in the local food. It does sure add miles potentially from the source to the end market, but is that a viable option, a good option? As long as there's some sort of boundary, what is the zone that then defines whether or not that's a good sustainable system? And then the other is what role cooperative extensions or some of the educational institutions that are training farmers, the few young farmers that are coming forward and interested in starting CSAs or local production, distributing their food in this way, what role do they play to provide support and outreach and so on? So if you know if you heard anything about that, it would be interesting to know or perhaps future research topics.
Great, more conversation. These are you're giving us ideas for future student projects as well. And if you have ideas for other future projects for future years, we are open to them and would love to hear them.
Hi, my name is Mark Jones. I have a question. Over the last 3 years, the students in your class or a similar class have come up with a broad range of studies that you've only looked at for about a semester. Do you see any utility in formalizing the assessment of our local food system? And if so, what would you prioritize, and what would your objectives be? And maybe if several of you could.
It's a great question, and we're about ready to circle back to the assessment phase of the class. It's a 3-year progression that we work through, and we've just been talking about what we should be doing. Do any of the students have comments on that question? It's a great question. Let me just... Anne, a previous student, you want to start with that? Okay, I'll start.
I guess we have to be mindful that the food system is incorporating so many different things. Like, we have the producers in the area, the farms, and then we have, you know, consumers, but we have different levels of consumers, and we have different, like, the food bank is specifically targeting not necessarily to be a exclusive supplier. Like, they really only function as, like, a, you know, we're going to give you some food and that's going to last you a little bit, or supplement. Like, there's just so many different levels. I think kind of sorting through all that is going to have to be a priority, and at least so that's like an accessibility thing, and then affordability also I think is going to be huge, especially with rising fuel costs. You know, the local movement is going to be more important, and I don't know, I guess to a certain point we've talked about this in our class, how the cheap cost of food that travels, you know, thousands of miles is not, you know, those days are kind of numbered. So at some point the local thing won't seem so expensive anymore.
I think we're at the point where we need to match supply and demand, and that's why I think Kate's project is going to be really important, because we've reached a point where so many people are interested, but they can't deal with smaller suppliers, but they can with even, you know, as Casey mentioned, like a horse and buggy model, or if through the local food center that can be a center for distribution, both virtually. There's an example, for instance, the Oklahoma Food Co-op has software that's available that's out there, and I just forwarded it to Kate, that, you know, is a way for people to say, I want to buy this much of X, and then a farmer says, okay, well, I'll supply you with that. And it's all automated, so it's much easier. So I think we've reached a point where we need that community higher level of kind of input-output distribution system. Also, I think Ann Malik left, but there is a frozen county position that is, I think we need a person dedicated to it that's an agricultural planner. So if you live in the county, tell your supervisor you want them to unfreeze that position so we can have one person actually working on that farm to school, all of those things.
Any other students want to comment on that? I will just put my own stuff out there, Mark, is that from my perspective, I would love to see a formalized assessment. And I think the goals are really simple. One is to increase the viability of our local farm economy. One is to increase the affordability and access to fresh, local, healthy food. So that's two. And three is to increase our security so that if there are problems with interruptions of food supply, that we have, you know, a week or two or whatever, we might be able to create some kind of buffer sources of food locally. To me, those are the big ones. Yeah. You want to add?
I wonder, Tanya, how you feel about whether we need some sort of more official framework in which to be thinking about assessment, but also policy and all the things we might do to support, to promote a more a local sustainable food system. Do we need, for instance, a local food policy council? And Ann says yes. And there are lots of places around the country now that have them. They're usually advisory. They don't have a lot of power, but they raise visibility and they coordinate and
they formalize
the assessment, and they also express the values you've just said in a very official way. And I think that is would be a valuable thing to have. So, yeah. Other responses to that, though?
Couple responses. This is great. This is exactly the kind of conversation we had hoped for.
To follow up on that, what, if anything, is UVA doing right now or will do in the future, perhaps to work with other schools that are in, I guess, farming locales? You know, we're in the South. There's a lot of arable land around here. In terms of coming up with something like, I know for entrepreneurship, there's the Global Entrepreneurship Monitor, monitors entrepreneurial activity around the world. You know, they talk with entrepreneurial colleges in every country, and they know exactly what's going on every month, every year with that. Maybe something for local farming. Are they making more money? Are margins increasing? Is the support in the community? And then that kind of puts a little more broadcast on the local message.
I have to say that Tim and I are kind of, well, probably I am, Tim's not, but we're what we're doing is low on the radar, although it's rising on the radar. But in terms of UVA, when you ask about what is UVA doing, it's really individuals like us who are trying to make things happen in a very small way. For things to happen in a big way at UVA, it would have to garner the attention of UVA leaders, of the leadership, and Board of Visitors. And I think it will get there. I think with the interest of the students and green dining and everything, and we are, I know one professor from economics, from commerce has left, but there's beginning to be a group of people across departments and schools at UVA who share this interest, who are starting to come together to see how can we work together, but it's all just starting. So the answer is right now, what are we doing? Probably not much more than what you see, but we like to think that that's something, and that's starting the ball rolling, and we hope in 5 years that it will be much more that the university is doing. Is that fair?
I just had one more comment with regards to tools and distribution systems and internet-based solutions. We've just heard about one from Oklahoma. This might be a fruitful area for students to follow up on. And there's some other systems out there that are coming into being. I think there's a private for-profit one that's just being launched or about to be launched out of California that a woman has developed. And there's a major, large nonprofit in Portland, I believe it's Ecologic, that's working very hard on this. If you Google the Beeline Project, some MBA students I know won a major international design competition last year using that, and that was their solution, and that's now been folded into Ecologic's work as well. So there's some things coming out of the West Coast, I know, along these lines that are really helping to eliminate inefficiencies or decrease inefficiencies in the system, how to get a whole lot of small producers and a whole lot of small consumers, restaurants and individuals, and try to pull them together. And so those folks don't have to be the distributors, the connectors, that there can be other means of connection.
That's great. I would love it if you would send me that stuff, Joe. I want to mention that I'm working with a group in Maryland, and they have launched something called agtrader.com. It's out of the University of Maryland, and they have just launched it, I think, 2 weeks ago. And it is, in fact, one of our students mentioned, something like a Craigslist for agriculture, and this is exactly what it is. It is a place where, whether it's hay or poultry manure or peppers, that you can say, I either want this or I have it, and you can trade it. And they are going to make it available for Virginia if we want soon. So who was over here? Yes.
I was wondering if there's any updates or any more information about a proposed plan I had heard about UVA perhaps developing a large vegetable garden operation at Moravin Farms.
Aha, and the dwarf again.
It's a fabulous idea. I'd like to hear more about that.
Anne has done an independent study this semester to using public involvement methods to explore this possibility.
Yeah, thank you. Jason from the Seaville, who wrote about it, is back there. Thank you. You know, it wasn't really my idea to do the project. I had heard just being a part-time student since 03 and just talking to a professor, talking about local food, I've heard about Morven from so many areas, and I actually live near there. So I went out there last semester for a project and continued this semester on a project out there. And I can't speak for the UVA Foundation by any means. However, they have just hired someone to focus solely on Morven. And so they have offered me the opportunity to present to this person what I found. And basically what I did was have two public visioning sessions where I asked people, what would you see as, you know, a student, as professor, UVA, to do with Morven? And a lot of it surrounded growing food and looking at carbon sequestration. And those two things, of course, go together very well. So I'm working on finishing up that project, and I hope they'll take what all of the input has been into account. That's all we can hope for. Yes. Mm-hmm. UNISER, Montana, Yale, Michigan, Santa Barbara. There's actually quite a bit. So one of the things I'm doing is also compiling kind of an appendix or a list of all of those with examples for them, many of which actually include the student component as a kind of a service learning type experience. And certainly I think that would be a valuable thing as well. Thank you.
Is that it? If anyone else? Any other questions? Let me say that the students, if you want to delve further into their reports, you have just basically seen the skimming the surface of a lot of work that they've done over the semester, and their reports will be available online if you have signed up. Where's Elaine, do you have a sign-up sheet? If you have signed up with your email, we will be sending out to you the link when all of the reports are finally up, so you can delve further into what exactly they did and their methods and more about their conclusions. And with that, let's give our students just a huge round of applause. And thank you all for coming, and help yourself to food.
You've been listening to Healthy Communities, Healthy Food Systems, Global Local Connections, the third installment of a course put on by Timothy Beatley and Tanya Denkla Cobb at the University of Virginia. This recording is made possible via the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at cvillepodcast.com.